So we have to ask the question, how do we as Christians relate to what I've laid out before you? What are the things we can do? But in trying to answer that question, I want to forewarn you of what not to do. And I see so many evangelicals really being intimidated or seduced by this new movement of spirituality and basically buying into the message that's coming over the internet and Hollywood and the TV that Christianity is out of date, it's judgmental, anti-homosexual, hypocritical, out of touch with reality, overly politicized, insensitive, exclusive, and dull. Now, I suggest to you that that's probably what the Romans thought of the early Christians, too. Indeed, I have the proof. Tacitus actually called the Christians haters of humanity. Is that any way of doing sensitive evangelism? Obviously, Christianity had something to say that was radically opposed to the pagan worldview of ancient Rome, and it's just as radically opposed to the paganism that is taking hold of our culture today. Compromise is not the way forward. But there's this conviction growing among young evangelicals in particular that we cannot speak to the culture until the culture likes our message. But is anybody asking why the culture likes what it likes? That's the inspiration behind these lectures for me, to try to expose what has created this culture, which has been really a determined effort from Jung onwards to propose a totally anti-Christian worldview that this culture has adopted in an incredibly powerful way. Remember Jung's vision of the future. He argued that the Christ symbol lacks wholeness. Wholeness is found in the reconciliation of the opposites of good and evil, male and female. This will create a new unitary world, the ultimate ground of the universe. And to get this to happen, agents of change must infiltrate into people from many centers via the tantalizing notion of sexual freedom to create an irresistible mass movement that will undermine 2,000 years of Christianity. That was the marching orders that Jung gave to those around him, and that's what they did. And Jung succeeded where Julian failed, according to his biographer. So I just want to encourage you folks that conformity and being liked by this culture is the worst possible sign that you're on the right track. Because the culture will order up what it wants to hear. And if you simply study the culture and then figure out what it likes and gives it to them, you're not doing theology, you're doing sociology. And you see, the gospel is a word outside that comes into the culture from the exterior. And that's what we must consistently affirm. Paul, you know, saw the dangers in his own time. Remember he said in Romans 12:2, do not be conformed to this world. The verb here is suschematizo. Schema is the essence of that word. Do not be part of the world's scheme. Distinguish yourself from that worldview. Do not adopt the philosophy of the culture. He actually argues that that philosophy is foolish. Has God not made foolish the wisdom of the world? He says, don't be conformed to its passions or lusts. And those passions appear in Romans 1:24. Therefore, God gave them over to the passions or lusts of their hearts to impurity. And Paul's exhortation to Christians is, walk by the Spirit and do not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. Pagan passions and pagan thinking all come from the same source. It's what I believe Jung unleashed on Western culture. So We need, like Paul, to have a healthy mistrust of the culture while having a deep love for sinners, by the way. So mistrust of the ideology of the culture and cultural leaders and a love for sinners. Because, as Paul says, the wisdom of the world is foolish. The God of this world has blinded people's eyes. He talks about the lie, you see, which is the result of the devil's work. And so we're following the prince of the power of the air. And so Paul represents to Christians in Rome a view of the world that is not synthetic but antithetical, that we are engaged in a struggle between two diametrically opposed worldviews that I've tried to call for simplicity, oneism or twoism. And that those cannot be joined together, you see. They are diametrically, radically opposed. There is no way of bringing those two worldviews together. That's why we were saying in the break, there's no such thing anymore of debate or conversation. So various groups come together to discuss the pros and cons of things, because we've got to a point where we sort of realize that there is a radical antipathy between these two worldviews. But of course, Christians today are animated by all kinds of reasons why they should conform to this culture. The first is fear of the culture. The intimidation factor is enormous, isn't it? You notice it. As soon as you put your foot forward and make a statement, you're pounced on and you are silenced. You see this on the university campus. The Christian groups are often living in fear of what the campus administration will do if they step out of line. And so Christian groups have sort of drawn back into themselves, and they try to invite individuals, but they no longer seem to propose a campus-wide debate on the truth of Christianity. That used to happen. It doesn't anymore. So that's fear. The second response, which is wrong, is seeking approval of the culture. And doing that, you see, we're tempted to modify the message. Our difficulties, it is believed, are self-imposed. The culture dislikes us because we have the gospel all wrong. We're far too focused on ourselves and our success in avoiding hell. And this is no message that we should give out to the world. We should avoid, thus, any mention of sin, the cross, personal salvation, sexual sin, because that obviously is judgmental. And there's a naive belief, you see, that if we modify the message, that the opposition of the culture will disappear. Well, it probably will. If we change the message, why should the culture worry about us? And there is finally then the temptation to assimilate into the culture so that there really is no distinction between the culture and the church. I found this expressed in a few ways. Non-Christian progressivism demands this of the church, according to this Australian Jungian David Tacey. He says, if spirituality wants to survive today, it must play the role in the future by listening to the world and discerning the presence of God, obviously Jung's God, in it. So that's what he proposes to Christian students who follow his classes at his university, that we must start listening to the world, discerning the presence of God in the world. And a British emergent leader states this: we must admit that God is doing something new in the city and affirm the essential goodness of the culture. We need to completely rebirth the church into the culture and adapt to it. Getting people saved is not the main goal of the church. I'm not sure what is, by the way, but simply disappearing, really, into the culture. And of course, this means ultimately the collapse of Christianity. it will disappear if we follow this route. As evangelicals do sociology rather than theology. You know, squirming in a culture that hates the idea of the transcendence of God, many evangelicals look at what the society presently is doing and accept this as valid, especially as it gets clothed in the liberal values of self-authentication, equality, respect, tolerance. It all sounds so very spiritual, but of course it has no reference to God, the Creator. Those values are mere humanistic values. And what happens is that the godless anti-Christian culture becomes the umpire of, or grill through which, is determined what constitutes the acceptable Christian message. By conforming to the world, you see, we allow the world to establish what the message should be. And here's the proof. It's very interesting that mainline denominations, though in serious decline because they have left the Christian message, remain the most likable and respected of religious groups in contemporary non-church society. There's the proof. The liberals are loved by the culture. But of course, they're having no effect in terms of church growth. So we conform to the culture's gospel. Brian McLaren says the cross is almost a distraction and false advertising for God. A priest in the San Francisco Cathedral, Alan Jones, whom McLaren endorses, says penal substitution is a vile doctrine. You see how far you can go in terms of compromising the Christian message in order to fit with the culture? Brian McLaren has come out and said how much he appreciates the work of a brilliant thinker, I must say, Ken Wilber, who is a Mahayana Buddhist and wrote the book A Theory of Everything. Some of you will maybe need to read this book because it is a very full-orbed view of what paganism intends for the future, A Theory of Everything. And McLaren seems to reflect this man. He says he loves to spend much time reading this book, so it is influencing him. So he wrote a book, Everything Must Change. For Wilber, the most crucial human problems are poverty and environment. For McLaren, systematic injustice, systemic poverty, and the ecological crisis are the most important things. Wilber has a 9-stage evolution of human transformation that goes from the beginning of religious history and ends up in a sort of non-dual nirvana where there are no distinctions and actually no human identity. McLaren believes Jesus' message of the kingdom points to a higher order system that continually invites humanity to move upward in the unfolding, emergent, spiraling process that integrates partial things into a beautiful whole. Though he doesn't accept the eschatology of Revelation, the book of Revelation. But Paul really distinguishes between the church and the culture. They are not the same. There is indeed, as I said, an antithesis. How can you get away from this? What partnership has righteousness with lawlessness, says Paul? What fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? What portion does a believer share with an unbeliever? Therefore, go out from the midst and be separate from them. This doesn't mean you create holy huddles as such, because Paul says if you do that, you can't witness to people. But you really don't identify with them in their ideology. But here we have Brian McLaren invited by this pagan progressive vision project to include his vision for the future. And so you put all these visions together by promoters of various forms of pagan spirituality in its progressive advance. And Brian McLaren accepts in full agreement the project, which states that the project is key to synthesis. So the idea of the conflict of truth and falsehood is gone. It's synthesis that is seductive. In terms of sexuality, and I just cited as an example, and I have to call her an ex-evangelical, though she probably would still claim to be one, Rachel Held Evans, at the recent Q Focus, addressing 200 leading evangelical women in November 2013, encouraging them to abandon any notions of biblical womanhood and adopt a sort of genderless or unisex self-understanding. And so the distinctive image of God as male and female is dropped. And this, you see, is cutting-edge evangelical thinking. I say it's sociology, simply making the Christian faith fit with what's cutting-edge in the culture. No, let's not be fooled. The culture has a mind of its own, a oneist worldview, and that this worldly, upbeat, utopian vision is still the wisdom of this world in which we should no longer walk. I think we have to keep in mind what Paul tells the Christians of the first century to do. But of course, this vision of oneism is invading the church at this particular level. I mentioned the book Christianity After Religion. It's Diana Butler Bass's book. This is the future, Christianity After Religion, which is reconstructed along Jungian Gnostic lines. Harvard professor, I attended Harvard and listened to this man, Harvey Cox, speaks of the future of faith in 2009. And he claims we are entering the age of the Spirit, leaving behind the age of belief. That's useful. Cox argues that the ancient Gnostic texts show a wide variety of versions of Christianity, not just one, orthodoxy, of course. For Cox, the discovery and rehabilitation of the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas, which, by the way, I believe is a total failure, as primitive, opens the door for a refreshing new understanding of what original Christianity was. And so we're moving into this new age of the faith, which is a move, quote, to horizontal transcendence, whatever that is. Horizontal transcendence, I guess it's... or a turn to the... This is more like it, a turn to the immanent, to within. But you see what happens. The experience of faith is the experience from all religions. But he says this is the new Pentecost, the age of the paraclete, as Jung said. And now I get to this book by Diana Butler Bass again, who is a leading voice in progressive Christianity, but also influences the emergent movement. And so her book, Christianity After Religion, The End of the Church and the Birth of a New Spiritual Awakening, in 2012. This is endorsed by a number of emergent church leaders. Shane Claiborne hails her analysis as new life budding from the compost of Christendom. Brian McLaren says her voice is provocative, inspiring, a sage guide for the future. What does she say? She celebrates a religionless Christianity, shorn of creeds and dogma. I mentioned this earlier. And of an inerrant propositional Bible, and proposes a faith borne along by an undefined spirit into an age of pure inner experience with the Godhead, and here's that phrase again, defined in less dualistic terms and more as the nourishing spirit of Mother Earth. That's the God that we need to announce. It's interesting, you see, that this rejection of doctrine and creeds is really part of what I've been noticing both in ancient Gnosticism and in Eastern religions, the rejection of the mind. We must constantly destroy the mind, says the Hindu scholar. Rejection of God is what non-Christian spiritualists are requesting as well. The God of old-style religion is remote, detached, interventionist, supernatural. God outside us has to be destroyed so that the deep reality of God can be experienced. This awakening, of course, has nothing to do with Christianity, and much to do with this interfaith, syncretistic, utopian oneism. Indeed, Bass states, the next awakening will have to be an interfaith awakening. Since the 1960s, Americans have been in the midst of their fourth great awakening. I was wondering how much Jung fitted into this view of things. I like to get my thesis in once in a while, and I was not surprised to find that Diana Butler Bass recommends the work of the emergent writer Phyllis Tickle, who in her book, The Great Emergence, How Christianity is Changing and Why, recognizes two important figures, she says. The first, the importance of Jung's legacy in his questioning of the old definitions of the self. Wow. This is what is motivating her view of things. And the second one is Joseph Campbell, who was a slavish disciple of Jung, who sort of promoted a pagan view of existence in America on public television. He was a friend, by the way, of George Lucas and helped George Lucas create the myth of Star Wars, where you get the dark and the light side, which comes directly from Jung, by the way. The dark side and the light side are Jungian notions. And Phyllis Tickle recommends Campbell's, quote, disestablishment of what is called Christian doctrine, and particularly Christian exclusivity. So she thanks this apostate from some form of Christianity. Joseph Campbell was a Catholic. She thanks him for undermining the notion of Christian exclusivity. This is where the conformity to the world will get you. You will finally deny the essence of Christianity, and you will be popular, but the gospel will be silenced.